Here we go. Good. Well, so here we are in week five. I do have an important practical announcement to make about week six. I'm going to be traveling next week, and when I look more carefully at my schedule, I realized that I will not. I'll still be traveling when the regularly scheduled phone call would happen. So I'm going to have to postpone week six by 1 week. So we will not have a session, a phone call next Sunday. It will be the Sunday after. So I apologize, and I hope it doesn't interfere with your plans too much. But next Sunday should work fine for me. I will be calling from a hotel room, but I imagine that'll work. But it'll be the next meeting will be 2 weeks from today, not 1 week from today. So, Kathleen, if you could let people know fairly soon so that they can make plans, that would be helpful. And it's on our recording. Okay, so that's the only practical issue that I'm aware of. So we're going to talk about this very interesting chapter. It took me several readings to really let this fall into place. The thing that finally made it fall into place for me was the title of the chapter, which is Lower Knowledge, A Hindrance and an Opportunity. I think if you realize that the focus here is lower knowledge, that becomes really interesting. And we will look at that. That'll be our main focus after we do some practice, although the practice will also fit into that. So, as I said in the orientation, and as I'm trying to do right now, we will start with some practice, but we will want to I'll want to set up the practice. So I'll spend a few minutes talking about exercise 29, which is awareness as a reflective surface. That was the practice you did during the week, and so you have some familiarity with it. But I want to take a little time to lay out, in the context of this chapter, how we can work with the practice. So about 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll do the practice and we'll discuss it, and then we'll go on to say some more about lower knowledge. And what Rinpoche means by that. I think it's really helpful to get clear on that. So, okay. Let's start with the way the chapter starts, which is basically to say that we are stuck in a certain way of knowing. And he calls it here the minding and belief structure. And he says that, beliefs and concepts are fine, but they proliferate. They limit the way we can know, and they sort of fill up all our space. And actually, we talked about that in the space section. And it's really good to remember that space is whatever allows, whatever is open to appearance, and the space of our appearance, if it's totally filled up with our beliefs about the way things are, and that really is, you could say, that's what lower knowledge is all about, then there's no opportunity for openness. There's no opportunity for any other way of knowing. And here, rather than using a kind of appropriate to talk about how we would like to develop more openness, that usually works. It usually makes sense. Because we are shut down to other possibilities in the domain of knowledge. And to say that what happens with concepts and beliefs is that we don't have any other possibilities, any other possible ways of knowing. It says here in the chapter that beliefs are massive solicitations of our attention. They're always calling out for us to notice them. And we respond, and so we live in the world that beliefs make available to us, and there is no other way to know. And as Rinpoche says at the bottom of this first page, this is really what I'm developing. and focusing on, as Rinpoche says, we are stuck in a way that makes it seem totally stuck, makes it seem as though there really is no other possibility, because we assume that reality is a certain way, and when reality is a certain way, then there are only certain ways to know it, through beliefs and concepts, but also through sense perception and so on, the whole range of possibilities that's available or open to us is determined by our sense of what counts as real. It's determined by our sense of the way things are. And so when we're talking about the way things are, and this is a phrase that I've come to be very fond of in English, I think in German it's pretty similar. You can say wie die Sachen sind, how things are, the way things are. What I like about the phrase is that it's not just that things are, but that there's a way that things are. And the way that things are is, you could say, lower knowledge, or is the outcome of lower knowledge. We'll talk about that more later. But in terms of what we've been talking about for the last few weeks, you could say the way things are, that's the logos, or that's the readout. There are only certain things that ways that 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 or certain ways that things can be. There's only, there's just the way things are. So when things are a certain way, then we can only know in a certain way. And it's actually very interesting. I was thinking this morning, as I was reviewing, of a couple of phrases, a couple of sayings that are attributed to Einstein. I think there's some question about whether he said them, but you hear them a lot. And one is that the great wonder in the universe is that our capacity to know seems to match up with the way the universe is. He says that's the real miracle. I'm not so sure he uses the word miracle, but he says that's the most amazing thing, is that those two things line up. But in terms of the TSK vision, it's just absolutely, it has to be that way. Our way of knowing and the way things are completely interdependent. There's no other possibility. And then the other thing Einstein says that's often quoted is, you can never understand something at the same level that it's been set up. Or you can never, I think he's talking about problems, you can never solve a problem at the same level at which it's been created. And that has to do also with, the way of knowing. We can never really know things in a new way as long as the only options for knowing are the ones that are given by the way things are. So we have to be able to break out of that. And we have to, in some sense, be able to break out of the logos. Now, break out isn't really the right word, because, as Rinpoche says in this chapter, we have to be able to know the knowing of the logos with the knowing of the logos. I'm actually referring back to something he says in an earlier chapter. So breakout isn't quite right, but we have to break through our ordinary limited ways of knowing, which is lower knowledge. It's what the logos has to offer us. So exercise 29 is a very interesting and important move in that direction. So what it's offering is a different way of knowing. And it's not easy to find a different way of knowing. Of course, you could say a lot of the exercises from the TSK books, I mean, you can look at all of them in a sense as inviting us to know differently. But when you try to know in a different way, it doesn't really work to try to break out of the usual structures, because lower knowledge will just kind of expand its horizons to include whatever this way of knowing, this other way of knowing that you're trying to develop, to include that. Lower level knowledge is very, or the logos is very flexible in that way. It breaks, it bends, but it doesn't break. So when you're looking for a different way of knowing, it has to meet certain criteria, which are discussed in this chapter. And this exercise meets those criteria, and that's why I wanted to take a little time to talk about it, to kind of set up what is the significance of the exercise. So, on the one hand, it says in the chapter that if you want to challenge the usual ways of knowing and the usual way things are, you have to be able to criticize the old approach, and this is on page 234. Let me look at it actually for a moment. You have to be able to criticize the old ways of knowing. He's talking about resolving doubts about whether it even is possible to have a different way of knowing, right? Or what that would mean, or what the significance of it would be. And he says, what you have to do is criticize the old approach, without preserving any of the basic terms or presuppositions of ordinary knowledge. So normally, I guess when we talk about criticism, we think in terms of writing and thinking, that kind of critique. But you could take exercise 29, the awareness as a reflective surface, as itself being a critique of our ordinary way of knowing, because our ordinary way of knowing, of course, is focused on the self, as the knower, as the bystander knower who reaches out to know objects, right? Outsiders or outside standers. This approach challenges that, critiques it, undermines it. And it does it in a very, very simple way, just by flipping the focus, so that the instructions basically say, instead of reaching out to know, let whatever arises simply be known. And then it goes on to say, in the beginning, that means you're just very passive. But eventually, you really want to practice the exercise in a way where the whole idea that there is someone who is a knower, even if that knower is being very passive and receptive, you want to let go of that as well. So the basic approach here is to undermine the fundamental structures of lower-level knowledge, and that's one of the criteria, you could say, for the kind of knowledge you would put in place that would be different from ordinary knowledge, or I think we can say different from lower-level knowledge. We'll talk later about the difference between ordinary knowledge and lower-level knowledge. There is another point, though, which is on 235, which is that if you're going to know in a different way, you don't leave the realm of ordinary knowing. And that's talked about in the first full paragraph on 235, where he's talking about knowing, and he says this kind of knowing is not set apart from ordinary knowing by some state-specific boundary. I'm not going to talk about that. It is relevant because it actually apprehends the same content that we know. The point is that it does so without reinforcing ordinary evaluations and preferences regarding what is given in that content. So you question the content, but you don't reject it. So that's exactly what exercise 29 does. It questions the content by undermining its status, you could say, as the object of what's known, by letting the knowing, letting there be knowing, so starting with the sense of a passive knowing. And of course, the image here is of a mirror, that objects appear in a mirror, and the mirror doesn't have to do anything about that. So it's, there's even a traditional Buddhist term for this kind of knowing, which is exactly mirror-like awareness or mirror-like wisdom. So that's the same image. I don't think we need to try to connect it up to the Buddhist side, but it's interesting to note that the image is the same. But the sense of it is this kind of completely different way of knowing, but a way of knowing that doesn't depart from what we ordinarily know. It's just, it allows. And again, that's something that's true for most TSK exercises. But here it really comes to the center. So we challenge lower knowledge without departing from lower knowledge. And I want to make one more point, really, and then we'll do the practice. And that is that this is a great example, it seems to me, and I'm bringing this up especially for people who are in the teacher training program. This is a great example of why you need to read the books, or why it helps to read the books. You know, there is a kind of a split among people who are interested in TSK, who find it rewarding to work with it. There are some people who say, well, I've read the books and I love the books, but I never do the exercises. And then there's some people who say, I've done all the exercises, they're great, but I can't read the books. You know, both ways are valuable, and there are people who really fall in love with the TSK vision, which is a very helpful thing to do, from both perspectives, or from either starting point, and that's fine. Ideally, though, you really do want to be able to see how the two come together, and this is a good example, it seems to me, because you can do the practice. You can do awareness as a reflective surface. I think you could introduce that, and in fact, in the Nyingma centers, they do. You could introduce that without reading the TSK books, and it would be valuable. It is valuable. But when we understand what's at stake, I think it takes on a different dimension and a different depth. And that's why I've taken some time now to lay it out. So at that point, or at this point, we are ready to do the practice. So the practice is awareness as a reflective surface. Let me just look at the instructions for a moment again and see if there's anything that it would be good to call our attention to. The instructions are quite straightforward. Instead of manipulating your mind or knowing capacity so as to seize upon objects and therefore thereby know them, that's part of lower knowledge, is the sense that that's the way you know. Instead of doing that, simply allow all objects to be known. And as he says in the beginning, means taking a passive role. Everything that draws near is accepted and reflected. But later, or maybe since you've been doing it for a while, you can look at this, look at it in this way. After you've practiced in a while, you de-emphasize the presenting to picture and the sense that the knowing capacity is yours. Let's do it. So we'll spend about 5 minutes, maybe even a little longer. It's not very long, but it should be enough to give you a sense. So let's spend about 5 minutes now doing this practice, awareness as a reflective surface, in light of what we've talked about so far. Okay? Okay, let's come back together and let us know what you discovered, what you noticed, what seemed to shift there. Okay, so David has something ready for us. Great. He says, aware of movement. Of the sun-dappled leaves outside, the ceiling fan circling above, creating a breeze, the hair on my arms tingling, my eyes surveying the expanse of the field outside, grass waving, movement beckoned, feelings of curiosity dissolved, just carried along by the currents, no conclusions, no self-importance, no constructing meaning, almost dreamlike. Well, that's very nice, David. It's very evocative. It has a kind of a dreamlike quality to it. Thank you. The phrase that I'm going to seize on there is when you say no constructing meaning, because I was struck by that also. It's not just that the bystander reaches out to know objects in the sense of perceiving them. The act of engaging the world is much more complicated than a kind of a simple perception, which is how we often think of it. And a large part of it is that we have to construct meaning. We have to assign meaning to everything that comes up. And it's a lot of work. And letting go of that is very relaxing. And dreamlike is one good way of pointing toward that. Okay, Klaus says, the practice is more easy with visual objects, space, more difficult with feelings, sounds, and thoughts, time. Okay, well, I'm not sure you'd always want to break space and time out in that way, but I certainly understand the point. It's interesting to reflect on why. I mean, I think that's right, in general. Especially when you're starting with a session. And it may be because we just associate feelings, sounds, thoughts, well, maybe not sounds so much, but feelings and thoughts certainly, with a self. And so the idea that they could be kind of passively presenting themselves while we were being simply receptive is more difficult. We already acknowledge or accept that objects have a status apart from us. Now, whether that's true is a different question, or whether that's also just a part of lower knowledge or a part of the readout. That's a different question. But that is how we tend to see them. So it's a little bit easier to imagine that we would take a different position. That's my sense anyway, of my why it might work that way. I suppose the more basic question to ask yourself is whether that's your experience, that it's easier to do the practice with visual objects. But that was Klaus's experience, and it's been my experience too. Okay, Caroline says, it's like being at the heart of the aliveness of being alive without commentary. Very nice. I will let that speak for itself without commentary. Karen says, relaxing, more lightness and appreciation about the richness of experience. So there is this theme that's emerging, it seems, of relaxation, letting go, no commentary, no constructing meaning. And I've already said this, but I'll re-say it in somewhat different words, perhaps. It helps you to recognize, I think, how busy we always are. Even when we, even if you sit back in your chair and you lean back and you just look around the room, you're incredibly doing an incredible amount of work just making sense out of everything. And it's work that we really don't have to do. And when we don't do it, then it seems, judging from the comments you've been making, it seems like you come more alive, you're more relaxed. Things feel lighter and more open. Eliana says the practice, oops, I lost that, sorry. Eliana says, for me it seems that as a reflective surface I can only perceive with the senses and feelings or have insight without words. Any discursive thought is a product of the self trying to explain what's going on. Well, that's a really nice observation, but it also suggests that you could explore that further. In one sense, that seems to me exactly right. The self is really busy making sense of things. We've talked before about what that means, this making sense. And if you let go of that, if the self doesn't have a job anymore, then you would expect there wouldn't be thoughts. But I'm not sure that's the final statement, that's the final word. Because the self, well, how shall we say this? I guess the question to ask is, what's the possibility for thoughts to show up in this passive way without someone thinking them? Thoughts without a thinker, as the title of a popular book has it, although the book, when I looked at it, I was disappointed because it really isn't about that at all. But the phrase is very nice. And so that would be the question. So you're saying it's more difficult to imagine how that could be, or in fact, that's in your experience. It doesn't work when you're talking about thoughts because the very notion of thinking is already a reaching out to engage. So I'm saying yes, that's a good insight and it's a good distinction to make, but it's also worth exploring further to see does that have to be the truth of thoughts? Okay, John says, I noticed that awareness soon absorbed even myself as an object of reflection. And this shifted awareness into a field that is not centered in myself. Yet myself still functioned, but more lightly. And maybe that relates to what Ileana said and what I was saying in response to what Ileana said. The self and thinking may still be operating, but maybe not in the same way, more lightly, as you say. So again, this theme of lightness and relaxation. There is a danger, I suppose, that word is a little too strong, but there is a danger that if we say, well, when the self is active, then that cuts off the possibility of awareness in this reflective kind of way, because the two are opposed to each other. If that's the case, then you're drawing a limit. You're creating a boundary. So I would just be open to the possibility that the self could still be functioning, but more lightly, as John says. And Bruce says, dropping into a more passive mirroring mode, the objects themselves came alive. Yeah, we haven't talked about that yet, so I'm really glad you bring that up. More fluid, dynamic, shifting than they had seemed a moment before. Well, I think it comes up a little in David's comment. But then David's always reaching out, sitting there on his porch or looking out his window to engage the world around him. I think he's got a very vivid sense of that. But that's what you're pointing to very directly here, Bruce. Dropping into a more passive mirroring mode, the objects themselves came alive, more fluid, dynamic, shifting than they had seemed a moment before. A quiet circulation, a slow percolation. That's a nice word. I've never ever thought of the word percolation in relation to TSK, but I think it's got possibilities. A slow percolation of images, sensations, thoughts. So you're not making a distinction. It's interesting. Images, sensations, thoughts presenting themselves, morphing, receding. A small shift in languaging helped ease the gap in knowing that still remained. Instead of letting objects be known, letting objects be knowing. Ah, well, that's interesting. And of course, it goes very much in the direction of the next exercise in this sequence, which we've done before, which is subject-object reversal. And it's also very much implied in the reading in the chapter today that that knowing is, you know, is not the property of a self. And when we've done exercise 30, the subject-object reversal, I've suggested that it's a little bit too limiting if you say, well, now the object becomes the knower, because in a way what you're doing is flipping the old model, but it's still the old model. The way you put it here, Bruce, I think is leaves that more open, which is good. The object can be knowing, but that doesn't mean that they are the knowers. It means that knowing pervades, and that, you know, we're going to talk in the when we're through with the discussion here, which is great. I mean, I think you guys are making wonderful points. When we're through with this, I want to say some more about lower knowledge and how that stands and how it relates to the logos and to ordinary knowing. This sense that there is knowing, that the objects are knowing just as everything is knowing, that that is lower knowledge, which is an opportunity. Remember, the chapter title says a hindrance and an opportunity. So I think you're engaging the opportunity aspect here. Okay, Michael says, the objective pole is a reflective surface known because of the light reflecting off its surfaces. So yes, that's a good point to keep in mind. You know, we actually only ever see reflections. Now we're talking about seeing with the eyes. And the subject pole, okay, is a reflective surface in which awareness reflects and refracts whatever is of interest to the subject. Right, that's the making sense part. So if you think about it that way, if you use that formulation, which I think is a good one, it's a good way of raising the issue, of presenting the issue, you'd say, well, okay, the subject has its own way of being a reflective surface, but we're talking about a different kind of reflective surface, which is not the subject. And actually, I think this is generally true. You know, let me go again to something that Rinpoche says in this chapter. He says, when we're talking about lower knowledge, things start to look very different. When you don't think of it as lower knowledge, but as lower knowledge, so that the knowing that's available is knowledge in a way that is not limited, you know, that is not separate from or lower than great knowledge, let's say. But in fact, what the self does, the way the self operates, is it's always trying to construct a kind of a self version, you know, a sort of dumbed down or limited version of knowledge, you know, because that's all that the self can contain, given that it's itself a construct, you could say. So the self is a reflective surface in which the reflection has to do with whatever is of interest to the subject, as Michael says here. And there's actually a rather long and very nice description in Love of Knowledge that I don't remember that well, but it's toward the middle of the book, that talks about the self as being like someone who's standing at the edge of a pool and looking what's reflected in the pool. That would be a place to look if you want to explore this idea further. Okay, and Ken has a couple of comments. How does we were being work? I'm not sure I understand that, Ken. I mean, is it other than an arising? It thinks so. Is it so? How is that known? So, Ken, are you emphasizing the past tenseness of it? And is you know, the we were being, is that what's seems to be to raise a different or other issue? I'll let you comment on that. In the meantime, you also say knowing pervades, but pervades what and where? Okay, that's a good question. Maybe the word pervade which seems to call for a what and a where, only does so in lower knowledge terms. I guess that's how I'm going to try to respond to that. Okay, so while we were being the exercise, okay, so that's the question. So how does we were being work? Is it other than an arising? It thinks so, is it so? How is that known? Okay, so if I understand you correctly, I think what you're pointing to here is that even when we set out to do the exercise, so we did the exercise, we were doing it a certain way as we were being a reflective surface, let's say, although the exercise does ask us to get away from that model in the end, which is probably a good clue. But while we're doing the exercise and kind of trying to drop our commitment to the self as the knower, we're still maintaining a commitment to the self as the one that is doing this exercise. And your questions, I think, very rightly point toward, at least for me, very rightly point toward letting go of those commitments also. The self is always making commitments, and basically, it's sort of like a marriage. The self is always renewing its vows to itself. Those commitments, wherever we become aware of them, it's good to, not to reject them, but to be aware of how we're making that commitment. So then that act of committing would itself be available for a reflective awareness. So yes, it's easy. In fact, it's natural to get stuck at a particular level, to say, oh, now I see more clearly, now I can let go of this particular commitment. But the whole time we're doing it, we're affirming another more subtle commitment. And Rinpoche points to that many times in the TSK books. And it relates back to what I said about why it's valuable in some ways, I don't know, essential maybe, to be able to read through, to work your way through, think your way through what it is that Rinpoche is saying. And that's an ongoing process that takes years and years. I've been doing it for a long time, and I'm still doing it. But it's very valuable because of this very point, that otherwise we make commitments that we're not aware of. Okay. So Caroline responds rather, to Ken's question, which I think is meant to be a provocative question. Knowing, he said, knowing pervades. Pervades what? Where? And Caroline says, could we say pervades everything, everywhere? And Ken says, yes. And then Ken says, double yes. He said double yes, so that makes it almost triple yes.
I think we need to say that it pervades appearances.
Pervades, okay, so Hayward is saying pervades appearances.
Appearances.
I like that. I think that's an important point to make. It has to do with this point that gets made in the reading we had, and that we've talked about a few times about lower knowledge. There's this italicized sentence on page 235 where Rinpoche writes, it is all just lower knowledge. And I think the it is what's pervaded, and a good way of describing that is appearance, phenomena in the sense of what appears. Whatever appears, whatever presents itself as real, is all knowledge. Here, I guess we've been using the word awareness, but I'm not going to try to make that distinction too much. Michael says, knowing perhaps pervades a multidimensional realm, so we're still reflecting that, of which we only see a reflection, like a two-dimensional mirror reflecting an unseen depth. Right. So you could kind of talk about a two-way pointing of knowing. It pervades appearance, but it pervades it in a way that points toward knowing as allowing a greater set of possibilities than just what appears. And I'm going to let myself assume that that's what you're pointing to with when you talk about a multidimensional realm. Okay, and that is the
Well,
last
could we say
comment.
that all appearances reveal time and space?
Yeah, you absolutely could say that. All
All of
appearance, you said it, I like it. All appearance is revealed time and space. And I have a note to myself here what we're talking about here really is very closely related to the practice that we were doing last week, which was exercise 48, where and 48, which kind of incorporates 47 in Love of Knowledge, which says, let time, space, and knowledge be at the center, and then subject and object are more the props, right? That with which time, space, and knowledge works. So yeah, that pervasive quality, and this goes back to the question, which I think is an open question and a very good question, can the self be active and operative without that being a barrier to the pervasiveness of knowledge, or I think you could say of time, space, and knowledge? Okay, let me just, well, okay, Ken asks,
Let's say the expressiveness.
the expressiveness, Hayward, say a little more.
Yeah, the expressiveness of time, space, and knowledge.
Okay, so it expresses itself in appearance, is that what you're saying? As appearance,
As appearance.
okay. And then Ken says, and then I'm just going to make one final comment and we'll close. Ken says, so knowledge does not have to be brought to experience. And I think, again, Ken, I'm beginning to get the hang of your questions, that they tend to be kind of provocative, or you could say rhetorical. But if I'm wrong, let me know. So you say, does knowledge have to be brought to experience? It seems as though it doesn't, from everything we've been saying, right? Because knowledge, knowing, pervades experience, pervades appearance, maybe even pervades the appearance of self who claims to know, because that's part of lower level knowledge, right? So those are questions to look at and explore. They're great questions. So let me just say about that, I want to make sure the distinction is clear, that when Rinpoche talks about lower level knowledge here, he's very careful to say that it's not at all ordinary knowledge, or that ordinary knowledge is a much more narrow concept. So we talked a long time ago about the relationship between lower level space or first level space. Notice he's not really using first level, second level, third level. He's talking about lower knowledge. I think maybe a second level. I won't worry about that. But he's saying lower level knowledge. So when we talked about space, excuse me, we said first level space is already very different from ordinary space or conventional space, because it is space, ordinary space, in the light of other possibilities or further possibilities. So that's the way you move beyond in the space realm. Here, it's gotten more, I don't know how to say it, maybe more fundamental, but I'm not sure that's right. He's saying that lower level knowledge is, or lower knowledge, is the whole realm in which ordinary knowledge becomes a possibility for the self. So it includes the self, it includes a world that can be known, it includes all of the possible ways of knowing. So in that sense, I think it really is pretty much the same as, or very closely related to, logos. Of course, the word Logos is not used in the first TSK book, but there's a something I'm not going to try to deal with now because we're out of time. But a question you could ask yourself is: is the logos itself a kind of meaning or belief, or is it what makes meanings and beliefs possible, or are both true? There is a statement on 236 where Rinpoche says, the world is a meaning, the world is a belief. So that's a good place to look for that question. And I will let Michael have the final word here. I'm just going to read his final comment. He says, how evocative this chapter is, both radical and allowing. Allowing because the vision of lower knowledge being a particular form of knowledge, but one that is on the same continuum with higher knowledge, allows the higher to be accessible within the lower. Right, and if it wasn't accessible within the lower, it wouldn't be accessible at all, right? And it wouldn't really matter to us very much. Okay, allowing in that way. Radical because we are also being told that we have to completely abandon all the ordinary presumptions and working methods of how we know in our ordinary, conditioned, inflexible, fundamentally restrictive ways of knowing. Okay, good. I'm going to stop with that. So again, we will not meet next Sunday. We'll meet the Sunday afterwards. And just in case anybody would like to at this late date, I think it's still possible to decide to go to England and do the retreat that we're doing starting on August 27th. Okay, talk to you in a couple of weeks.